Good morning, guests. Welcome to our bi-weekly episode podcast of Fixing Healthcare from the Trenches. It's a real pleasure to have our guest today, Dr. Simon Talbot, whose landmark article I quoted in my book, Healthcare from the Trenches, where I talk about the difference between burnout and what we call moral injury. We're going to have Dr. Talbot expand upon that. So Dr. Talbot is actually did his medical school education in New Zealand. He's a Kiwi, right, Simon? He's from Auckland, which I had the pleasure of visiting many years ago. Did research at Sloan Kettering in New York City, right up the street from where I trained, and then went to the Brigham and Women's Hospital, which many of you know is one of the major teaching hospitals for the Harvard Medical School. Did his plastic surgery, microsurgery reconstruction with Joe Upton, amongst others. And it's been hard to pin him down because he's very much into transplantation, microsurgical reconstruction, et cetera. So it is a pleasure to welcome Dr. Simon Talbot. Thank you, Simon, for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the time and I'm enjoying being here.
Wonderful. So tell me, what was the genesis with Dr. Wendy Dean, who I spoke to some months ago about this? Because there is this perception right now amongst the public about talking about burnout, saying physicians are, for a number of reasons, are burned out. What is your perspective on this?
So that's sort of the where it all started. Wendy and I met each other because of the work that I was doing in hand transplantation. She was working for the Department of Defense. I was working clinically. And so we sort of met fortuitously and we got speaking and realized that we both had the same impression as many physicians do, that the whole body of work and burnout was getting a little frustrating. You know, I was a busy clinical academic, both clinical and research surgeon, and she was a psychiatrist who had worked in direct care and had worked in private practice and had worked in academia and then moved to the military. And the two of us felt that the story of burnout didn't really fit what we were seeing and experiencing. At that stage, this was sort of burnout was being targeted as one of those things that was an individual problem. Solutions should be focused on the individual. And so the story went something like this. If you feel that you're exhausted, depersonalized, and lacking fulfillment in your career, you should go out and exercise more. You should drink more water. You should eat better food. You should probably start yoga and you should do some mindfulness. And I am not opposed to any of those things. They probably help some people and they probably help a lot of people, but they aren't the trouble that people are struggling with. And so we both said, look, we get that those things are worthwhile, but the reason we felt so many people were struggling, including ourselves, was that it was so difficult for physicians to do their job the way they knew how. And so with that in mind, we sort of penned a quick article over the phone. Wendy lives in Philadelphia, I live in Boston. And so we just phoned one another backwards and forwards and wrote this article together, published this article saying that we felt that moral injury was a term that better encapsulated the problems people were having, that better encapsulated the concept of, I have a moral obligation to take care of these patients. And if I can't do that, that hurts me. Right. And so we wrote that paper and then that just took off, literally.
So how did you actually meet? I'm trying to think about how a reconstructive microsurgeon met with a psychiatrist who's worked with you know, military.
Yeah.
Patients. How did you folks actually meet?
We both met through the American Society for Reconstructive Transplantation because I was doing reconstructive transplantation and Wendy was on the funding arm from the military. And so just completely, you know, randomly, we were both working in the same area in spite of very different trainings, but had the same experiences with patient care. And so that was our sort of, you know, that was the light bulb moment for the two of us.
Interesting. Yeah, so delve into that a little bit. I mean, I love the description in your article about the analogy about soldiers being, and you know, unfortunately, there's you know, three or four major wars going on right now in the world, and people are forced to go in and, and sometimes, kill people. They have nothing against, right? They have no qualm with these people. That's a really difficult thing. And it's such a fascinating analogy. Explain that.
So I will, in all fairness, say it's not a perfect analogy because, in the military, there are certain obligations that people have and certain expectations of the way that we will carry on. But I think that the way to think about it is that when you do something that breaches your moral code, that is internally painful. And in the military, that takes the form of, I was asked to do something. And, I was asked to go into a country and I was told there were weapons of mass destruction. It turns out there were no weapons of mass destruction. You know, when you go in there and do things that breach your moral code, that hurts. And so the definition of moral injury started in the military. And there's at least a couple of definitions. But the idea is that you are perpetrating, failing to prevent, or bearing witness to acts that transgress your deeply held moral beliefs. And in medicine, that takes its form in so many different ways. It translates to medicine. But the way I say it when I talk to people is I say, you've probably, if you're a doctor, you've experienced moral injury. It may not have overflowed yet, but you've experienced some of these things. This is not the family don't want to turn off the ventilator and you know that grandma is not going to survive. And that is a moral dilemma. And we all go through that and we expect that. And that's okay. But the moral injury happens when you know the best way to care for a patient, but you're unable to provide that due to constraints outside your control. And when I speak to different specialties, there's hundreds of different ways this happens. It might be their experience with the insurance company. It might be a demand for them to be more productive from a private equity group. It might be, patient satisfaction scores that mean it's really hard for them to actually talk to patients in the way that they know how. It might be that their company doesn't like leakage from the system. It might be bureaucracy or layers of management that make it hard for them to do their jobs. You name it. There's any number of ways that we can feel that we're not providing the best care that we know how, or not providing the care we'd want for ourselves or our family.
Yeah. I think the problem I have, and I'm sure you and Dr. Dean agree, is that we're actually quite resilient people, right? I mean, to make, I look at what your training was. I imagine you're coming from another country. You're coming into a very prestigious academic medical center. It took a lot to get there, right? So you're pretty resilient. I mean, this thing about burnout, there's a little bit of it of
insult.
Yeah, exactly. There's certainly an insinuation that you're not up to the task. And that's not the case. What it is that you're morally challenged with the fact that you're not being able to do what you really trained for, what you know is right, because there's outside influences. And this is what the public needs to understand when, I know they call my office, they go, oh, you don't take my insurance. Well, you need to understand why, or I have a patient and I can't get them scheduled for surgery because I'm waiting for something as inane, as absurd as an authorization number.
Yep.
There is the right. So it's not that we're burned out, and that's what I want. And when somebody says to me about burnout, I get personally insulted by that term. So.
Well, I think that there's two things you said there that are really worth bouncing off. The first is this idea of resilience. If you've gone through undergraduate, medical school, a residency, and a fellowship, and now you're in practice, you almost by definition have to be pretty resilient. But not only that, there's evidence for it. There was a paper out of Mayo that actually looked at this and said that physicians are substantially more resilient than the general population, and even went one step further and said that focusing on resiliency is not going to make the difference here because it's a systems problem. The second point is that I think you made really clearly, which is that part of the challenge here is not educating doctors about this. It's educating the public about it, because whenever I speak to doctors, it's always preaching to the choir. Everybody says, oh my God, that's me. That's how I feel. But one of the reasons that Wendy and I have been working sort of more broadly and writing a book about this was to explain to the public, when you go to your doctor and you feel frustrated, recognize that 9 times out of 10, they feel frustrated too. Maybe 99 times out of 100. Yeah. They're doing their best to try and take care of you almost always, but it's really hard in the system. And I think it's really important that the public recognize that, because if we're going to make change, it's not going to come from the 900,000 physicians in the US. It's going to come from the 350,000 public in the US.
Yeah, a million. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's I've been discussing that. But you know, I wrote this book. I'm going to give a shameless plug for it again. I actually so for those who haven't had a chance to see it, Healthcare from the Trenches, one of the chapters I quote Dr. Wendy Diem and Dr. Simon Talbot from their article about it, because I think it's chapter 12, and it is because this is a key aspect. And the public needs to understand that we are frustrated as well, because our hands are tied.
Yep.
And that's the part that has to change. And so for that reason, I want to transition now, Dr. Talbot, to, you know, giving us your three initiatives that you would like to see enacted, you think could really make a change for our healthcare system, which needs it desperately.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I love that part of it, because I feel that I tend to be someone who's very action oriented, like a lot of surgeons, and try to be positive about this stuff. And I got to say that telling people the problem is the first step, but thinking about ways to do something about it is by far the key part. And so I'll give you my three things, but first I want to categorize them, because I think there's actually 50 or 100 different things we should be doing.
Okay.
I think it's important to say that there's more than just three things, because every system is different, right? There are academic systems, there's VA systems, there's private practices, there's Midwest, there's East Coast, West Coast, South. There's all these different groups that have different challenges. And so no one fix is going to work for everybody. So I think the way I think about it is in two groups. The first is the relational groups. The relational breakdown that's happened in medicine, the lack of trust that's happened in medicine between groups within medicine, between administration and clinical staff, and even now between the public and physicians. So there's a relational breakdown, and I think we need to address the relational breakdown. And then there's the operational breakdown. And that's traditionally where people have focused, because they've talked about burnout and they've talked about what are the operational things we need to do. We need to focus on both. We need to focus on the relational stuff and we need to focus on the operational stuff. So here's my three things. The first is that I think we need to start focusing more on physician well-being and turnover as a critical part of what we're measuring and what we're actually trying to improve upon. We are very good at tracking things like press gainy and patient satisfaction. We are very bad at tracking where physicians stand on this stuff and where their turnover is. And we know, we even have data that physicians who are struggling cause patients who are struggling. Physicians who are struggling mean that patients aren't as satisfied with the work they get. I think we need to measure it and we need to track it and we need to be focused on it. That's number one. Wow. Number two, I think we need to look at our insurance system and track that in a different way. I'm not a fan of hyper-regulation, but I do think that we need to be looking at the way our insurance system works and thinking about the regulation of our insurance system. Things like revamping our prior authorization system so that patients aren't waiting for something that is immediately obviously necessary. Thinking about harmonizing reimbursement so that we aren't focused on reimbursement and so that hospitals and clinics and private practices don't have their own agendas. We should all basically get paid more or less the same for the same services. And the fact that one insurance company can pay 17 cents in the dollar and an international patient can pay 100 cents in the dollar makes no sense to me. There should be harmony of the way that work is reimbursed. In the same way as when you take your car in to be repaired, there may be some subtle differences between different places, but generally speaking, replacing the oil costs somewhere around the same amount.
So do you think there is insurance regulation? Because I've discussed this with people in the last few years, and the reality is that most people feel that there is no regulation.
There is regulation of insurance companies. The evidence for that was during COVID, where a lot of us got reimbursed from our insurances because they have to pay out 80% of the money going into them. However, I think a little bit like after the financial crisis in 2008, where the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau revamped the way that mortgages and credit cards were done, I think we need to go in and have the same level of revisiting the way that we regulate insurance companies. And I think that insurance companies should be part of the solution to reducing the administrative load. Currently in our health system, as a whole in the US, there are 10 administrators to every 6 clinical staff to every physician. Yes. And to me, that 10 administrative staff is not saying I shouldn't have a front desk staff, or not saying that I don't need an administrator keeping an eye on our finances. It's saying that there are people in buildings who are doing a tremendous amount of work that is probably relatively unnecessary as far as reimbursement and insurance and tracking that stuff.
Yeah, too many middlemen. I mean, it's just
too many middlemen. Yeah. I'm not saying that administrators don't have a role. I just think our ratio is wrong.
Yeah, the ratio. And then
number three, yeah. I think, and this is where the sort of operational stuff comes into it. I think we need to be thinking about getting doctors back to being doctors, getting rid of the unnecessary and overloaded administrative burdens. So, you know, there have been a few initiatives for this. Getting rid of stupid stuff was one of them. And there are many that are out there. But I think as a whole, there are so many unnecessary things we're doing as doctors that take away from the important stuff that we're doing and detract from our ability to take care of patients. When I have to dictate notes at the end of seeing a patient, and I have to say at the end of it that somebody else was the scribe in the room and that the patient was in the same state as me and I was at my place of work, and that the time I spent was 15 minutes with the patient and then 17 minutes additional work. I mean, these things are inane. And I think if any patient thought that we were wasting time doing that rather than actually taking care of people, they would be frustrated. And so that comes into the 30% of waste in our system. We got to minimize that 30% of waste. Imagine if we spend currently 17% of our GDP on healthcare. Imagine if we got rid of 30% of that. We've got 5 or 6% of our GDP back. And imagine the good we could do with that. So I do think that figuring out how to reduce the administrative burden as part of reducing the waste is very important.
Well, a lot of this waste and these rules are actually created by big institutions, probably by people who are hired to sort of create these rules, right? So this is where, because I can tell you, I'm not in a prestigious place like Brigham and Women's, but you know, yesterday I did my 12 or 13 surgeries in an outpatient surgery center. And my office is down the hall and it's completely private practice. And, you know, I'm very lucky in that I don't have to negotiate a lot of this challenges. And I think that the pendulum is finally swinging back to private practice, where we need, you mentioned all the different types of practice locations. I mean, we need VA hospitals, right? We need academic institutions like yours. We need city public hospitals, but there is a slow death to private practice in the U.S., and that's going to hurt healthcare a lot, because the bread and butter of physicians going to see their doctor is in a less stressful, less administratively burdened private practice, simple setting. Mm-hmm. And I think that we cannot lose that. And for all the reasons you just mentioned.
Yeah, so, I think, you know, we really need diversity in our system. We need to be able to take care of patients where they are and in the way that they are best taken care of. And sometimes that needs a different system for each different location and different type of patient. And right. and if we start changing our system to making those things impossible, you know, an awful lot of primary cares can't survive in our system anymore. They can't. They're all being taken out of private practice. Those groups are really important, and we've got to do everything we can to preserve diversity within our system for our patients.
Well, ultimately, our private, you know, primary care colleagues are the ones who are really going to keep us healthy, and that has a huge impact on that 17, which is really the last numbers I've been reading is closer to 19%. So when you think about it, we're almost one out of five dollars in the U.S., which is about twice as expensive as either Switzerland or Norway, depending upon which list you're looking at.
Well, it's funny when you think about, you know, appropriations and money that's spent in Congress, and you think about the nickel and diming people do over relatively cheap stuff, and then you think about the amount we're wasting. There are a lot of good things we could do with that extra few percentages of our
GDP. Oh my God! It'd be there certainly would be enough money left over for the safety nets. I mean, you know, we have people who talk about, you know, we want to socialize medicine. Well, you know, you probably know better than many of us, you know, about the NHS and similar systems. And look at our Canadian friends up north. I mean, they're really struggling with this. So I think tweaking our system is really the will be ultimately the best solution. That's why we're doing this, right?
People come from around the world for our system. There's something good about it.
Exactly.
We provide the very best healthcare in the world, but we also provide some of the lousiest healthcare in the world. And so the problem is, on average, we don't look real good. But if we could get everybody up to where the best healthcare that we provide is, we'd be in a magical place. And I really do think that we actually put enough money in to do that if we were just putting the money in the right places.
Right. Just shifting it. So I'm going to go very quickly to my three before we end. So one thing you touched upon is in terms of authorization. And finally, there is some movement away from this, right? In terms of pre-authorization. I mean, even the AMA, thank God, has a website for to bring attention to, minimizing or even eliminating the pre-authorization, which is an absurd concept. So I think that we do need oversight, though, right? I think you'd agree, Dr. Talbot, we need oversight. Absolutely. You know, there are bad apples. We all make mistakes. So we need oversight, not authorization. Number two is right specialist at the right time, right? How many times do we see patients who've been forced by the system to see their overworked primary care colleagues who should be keeping us healthy? And, you know, so in my case, they're not the first person to work up why they're having pain in their shoulder. That doesn't make sense. See the right specialist. We order less tests. We get to the clinical plan much quicker, much more efficiently, more cost effectively. And the last one is what we're doing, which I thank you so much for being on. The last thing is public education. The public, and you touched upon that, we need to educate the 350 million people. The question is, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, when, and you know, now we're very worried about political correctness, but when will the public say, this is my I can't breathe moment? We've seen major social movements create changes that are for good in society. When is the public going to get fed up with the fact that we have, you know, people controlling healthcare who really don't have the preparation for this? That has to change. So I give you the last word.
Well, I think the last word that I would put in is probably a response to that, which is that, I don't see healthcare as being a political issue. Healthcare is one of those things that we all need. We're all patients, even if we're doctors. And I do think that the sad thing that I see is that so many people realize how troubled their healthcare is when they need it the most and when they're very vulnerable. So my simple answer would be, I hope that as people hear this, they realize that the time that they can make a change is while they're healthy, while they're able to vote, while they're able to think about this stuff. And I hope that they'll talk to people like their congressmen, like their doctors, like the nurses they see, like the executives they see around in healthcare, to say how important this stuff is to them. And I hope that they'll let that message be heard loud and clear, regardless of which end of the political spectrum they're on, because we're all patients.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that. Absolutely. I mean, the challenge we've had with this podcast and so many others out there that are talking about these problems is really getting that reach. I mean, I kind of start joking, you know, this is not a Joe Rogan reach, right? I mean, this is an amazing, right? But if we could get that kind of penetration for that, then I really believe in my heart of hearts that we would see change. So thank you, Dr. Talbot, again, for being a guest. I mean, I hope many who are listening could take a time to read this. And your nonprofit is called Moral Injury of Healthcare, right? So please, look into this, comment on it, contribute, engage with it. And please join us in 2 weeks for our next episode of Fixing Healthcare from the Trenches. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.